other people, your competition supposedly, will not do. This will allow you to immediately carve out a space for yourself and develop an unfair advantage. Let me be clear. I want an unfair advantage. I'm ethical, but I never play fair. I want an unfair advantage if I can create one. Though I am always ethical, I never, ever play fair. I seek out ways in which I can get an unfair advantage always. And one surefire way to get an unfair advantage is to do what others will not do. Find something they cannot do. Maybe because of their size or their commitment to other projects, you can exploit that. Maybe they're cutting back during a time when the economy is uncertain. I recently went through that where a competitor, a direct competitor, was cutting back. I decided to spend all my money while he was trying to conserve it, because obscurity was a bigger problem for me than money. This would be your moment to expand into those spaces when they're contracting. A company I was recently working with that sells dental implants told me the leader in the field had cut their travel expenses and elected that all their clients be contacted by phone or over the net. So I convinced the company, do what they won't do, man. You get an unfair advantage. Get a competitive advantage, you just got to do what they do. Get an unfair advantage, we decided to dominate by making personal contacts while the leader was just making phone and internet. It's domination, man. You got to think in terms of domination, not competition. Never play by the agreed upon norms within your group operates. Every group, every industry, every sector has these agreed upon norms. The sacred cows, yeah. Look, the rules, the norms, the sacred cows, the traditions of any groups or any industry are usually traps that prevent that group from new ideas, higher levels of greatness, and pure domination. You don't want to be just in a race. You want to be at the top of the list of considerations. So when they go out for bid, hey, we really want Grant to do it, but let's bid on a couple other people just so Grant keeps us fair. You know, if Grant's close, then we're taking him. See, even better, you would like to be the only one in the race considered as the viable solution. Okay, Grant's really the solution. You know, guys, let's don't even waste time getting bids. Let's just go with Grant. You have so much power in your space that your clients, your market, even your competition has to think about you first every time they make a decision. IBM did this so successfully years ago that all PCs were then referred to as IBMs. There was a time when Xerox also accomplished this so successfully that all copiers were referred to as Xerox. They wouldn't even say print a copy. They'd say Xerox a copy. That's pure domination of a sector. And not correctly protecting your trademark name like Xerox and IBM didn't do, that's another issue. Look, the goal at my sales training company is not to compete with others in the space for the revenue or the clients. Our goal is to literally make sure that every human being on planet Earth equates Grant Cardone with sales training solutions. Achievable? Probably not. But it's a target we use for making decisions. You understand? It's a target we use for making decisions. Hey, should we promote this book out? Should we do whatever? Should we get an app out for sales training or closing the sale? Or it's going to cost money. Hey, what's our goal? My goal is to get everyone to equate my name, Grant Cardone, with sales training. If I achieve even part of that, do I accomplish goals? Absolutely. Domination. Our goal is to dominate the thinking of all people so that my name becomes synonymous with sales training. Google the term sales motivation and watch my video pop up. Okay? Think in terms of search. You're going to think in terms of Google. They dominate. That is the way to approach a sector, goal, or endeavor. To own it completely. Dominate the space. You can always learn from what others are doing. You don't want to chase them. Sam Walton, founder of Walmart, was said to shop other stores weekly in order to see what they were doing well. And then he would do everything he could to dominate that space. At that time, he also had the goal of domination, not the goal of competition. If you're going to duplicate the best of what others do, then hammer away at them, champion that practice, make it yours, own it. So people start to associate your name with that. Hone their specialties until they become your advantage. Do so to the point where you become the expert, the leader. People even think you were the creator, even if you weren't, in that area. So you dominate it so incredibly that they no longer even want to attempt competing with you. And you don't have to be first to a space to dominate it. but it's important to be considered first in the space. You see the difference? Joe creates something first, but when you think about it, you think about me first. You don't have to be first. You want to be considered first. That's domination. The message you want to send to the marketplace through your persistent action is, no one can keep up with me. I'm not going away. I am not a competitor. I am the space. Most of you will have less money than some of the leaders in your space. Even if you have less money than the other players in your market, that doesn't mean you're at a disadvantage. It means you have fewer choices, which might be good. Although they may be able to outspend you or out-advertise you, you can certainly outwork them by using social media, personal visits, mail, email, networking, phone call, friends, relatives, referrals, hammer, commitment, dominate, create campaigns using the resources you do have. Most people talk about their money. Look, your energy is worth more than your money. Energy is money. Most people talk about, oh, if I just had money, you know, it takes money to make money. That's garbage. It takes freaking courage and commitment and persistence to make money. There's no shortage of energy, effort, creativity, or how much you can contact your clients. There's no shortage of that. You got a money shortage, man. You don't have an energy, effort, creativity, or how many times you can contact somebody shortage. Use variations of campaigns, offers, information, videos, links, blogs, third-party validation, mail, email. Am I freaking you out right now, baby? I'm trying to dominate your thinking. Phone calls, personal visits, combinations, counter, left, right. Dude, you don't need to spend money on advertising. You need to expand and dominate your own thinking and then your presence in that market. Warning, when using activity to counter deep pockets, you know those guys that can advertise? Never underestimate how much activity actually takes to get noticed in the first place and then to maintain attention in your space. For example, people think that they can post on Facebook or Twitter, you know, once or twice a day, some people once or twice a week, and that you're going to create an effect. Look, you don't understand massive action if you think twos, if you think in twos twice of anything, if you think twice of anything once in a while is going to do anything, you're nuts. You don't understand massive action or how big the internet space is, and you're underestimating what it's going to take to actually get you considered if you think a couple of posts are going to get you noticed. I don't care what you write. You could be brilliant in both the posts. Like every other aspect of growing your business, you got to keep showing up over and over and over and make it obvious you're not going away. Follow me on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/CardoneSuccess, and you'll see what it takes to be in a space and to acquire new fans and new people without advertising, not spending any money, just effort. We tweet twice an hour, 24 hours a day. I want people to complain about it, okay? Complain I'm doing too much. I know I'm doing something right. Because what's going to happen is this. First, you get no attention, then you get a complaint, which is attention, and then you get admiration, which is good, positive attention. The good thing about social media is anyone can play in the space regardless of his or her financial situation. It allows for unlimited creativity and rewards only those who use it consistently and persistently. When I first started playing with social media, I use that word loosely, playing, because I don't play much on it, I posted twice a day. I didn't know what I was thinking. I was having a moment of average, a little think. We simultaneously at the same time began sending out email strategies once a month and found ourselves getting requests from people who wanted to be removed from our email campaign. My colleagues, people that work with me, suggested, hey, we should back off. We're getting complaints. People are taking us off. They're pulling off our strategies. They want to be unlinked to our email campaign. And one day I woke up and I came to my senses and I said, hey, you know what? If they're complaining, they're thinking about us. So I made the order. I want you to increase the post 10 times what we've been doing. I want to go out with more email strategies and campaigns, not less. I then instructed my employees to start sending out electronic strategies 8 times a month rather than once and began personally posting comments 48 times a day on Twitter and Facebook, an average of 12 times a day. Each of them was written by me and they were set out to be dropped at a certain time. Although you might assume that the complaints and unsubscribe, that's the word I was looking for a few minutes ago, would increase with this massive outflow campaign, they didn't. Oh, while we did increase numbers, percentage-wise, we didn't because we started getting more people to play. Instead, we started receiving emails and posts of admiration for my activity level. So this is what's going to happen. First thing you're going to do is get complaints. Second thing you're going to do is get criticism. Third thing you're going to do is get haters. Fourth thing you're going to do is get admiration. I'll talk about the haters in a second here. You need haters, baby. You want some haters. If you got 10, get you 20. We started receiving so much positive. Man, how do you do all this? How big's your staff? Where do you find the time? Do you ever rest? And for every person commenting, there had to be 1,000 thinking something similar. And who do you think they were thinking about? This wasn't expensive to do. It only cost energy, effort, and creativity. At the same time I was doing this, the guy who most people compared me to was asked the question, what do you think about social media? And he responded, I'm still evaluating it. While he's evaluating, I'm beating him to death. I'm posting one day on Twitter. I'm going to make Twitter my little bitch. I'm doing everything I can to tweet something to grab attention. This is a great example of domination and outrageous thinking, and the action costs no money. Think about domination like this. You can't dominate if you don't penetrate. And you won't penetrate by using reasonable levels of activity. Your biggest problem, remember, is what? Obscurity. They don't know you, man. They ain't thinking about you. Again, domination is about dominating the space so that when they think about your space, let's say you do apple pies. They think about apple pie. They think about, oh, I got to go to her. Another problem for all of this is just getting through the amount of noise in the marketplace. You're underestimating how noisy the marketplace is. You have to do two things. One, get noticed. And number two, get through the noise. In my case, had we made a decision to back off like my employees were telling to satisfy a few complainers that had already unsubscribed anyway and were never going to buy anything from me anyhow, okay, we would have not expanded our contact base. The more I posted, the more people liked me. The more I found out what people want to hear and don't want to hear. The more we put out, the more people we helped. As we blasted on this new program, we even saw posts from competitors mocking me. Now, this is important. You want criticism, man. You want to look for it. Yet even these comments brought attention to who? I got competitors. Cardone thinks this, or Cardone's doing that, or what's he doing over there? Okay? Who are they talking about? They're talking about me. When you're talking about me, who are you thinking about? Two things will happen when you take the right amount of action. One, you're going to get a new set of problems. And two, your competition will actually start promoting you. Can you believe it? I love this. When I've made such an impact on others who don't even know me or having conversations that raise awareness about my business, my products, and what I'm up to. People that don't even know my product or me are actually passing on my content and talking about, hey, did you see this? Because there's enough activity. Determine the capability, the actions, and mindsets of those whom you compete with. Do what they will not do. Go where they will not go. And think and take actions in 10x quantities that they can't comprehend. Don't get too involved in competing on best practices, because best practices is a competitive level. Take your actions to a point considered unreasonable by others, even the world. Where you're doing those things that only your company would do, only you could conceive of, and are willing to do, something I call only practices. For one company I once consulted with, we identified places in which only practices could be employed. We discovered the industry in general struggled with practices of following up with customers. They struggled with this practice. They didn't follow up well. So we looked at what our competitors would not do, not what they did do, but not do, and found that none of them would call back clients as they left the company or the store. This led the company to immediately initiate programs during which clients were called back as they drove away from the company. Managers then immediately started calling clients' cell phones as they left the company premises and asked them, Mr. Johnson, would you please return? Mr. Johnson's only a block away from the company right now. If the call went to voicemail, the manager left a message requesting that please come back immediately. I have something I must show you. Or the manager would send a text saying the same thing. If there was no successful contact made, another manager would then repeat the call back that same day. And again the next morning. The results were sick. They were crazy. 50% of the clients returned immediately of the ones they contacted, and almost 80% in total of those became buyers at that time. Another 20% returned as a result of the later calls and increased the sales of that organization to new and unseen before levels. This is an example of an only practice, doing what your competition will not do. Look, it doesn't matter what you do. It does matter that your goal is to dominate your sector with actions. that are immediate, consistent, and persistent, and at levels that no one else is willing to operate or duplicate. Am I overwhelming you right now? It's a lot, isn't it? You're like, damn, man, how am I going to do all this? Because you're going to get on my new pill, baby. The pill is massive action. The pill is domination. Take any action and take it to another level that will separate you and your company from everyone else that might be in your space. Be willing to spend every last bit of your energy, die in the effort and the creativity on distinguishing yourself as the only player, the dominator. Learn how to dominate by being first in the minds of your market, your clients, and even your competitors. Market conditions won't improve until you improve the way you think. Look, your economy's not going to get better until you get better. Even if you're in a weak market, you suffer less when you dominate it, right? If you can dominate a weak market, who's going to dominate when it's good? If you can dominate a great market, who's going to dominate when it's bad? Weak markets actually create opportunities because the players in that market typically have become dependent and weak, and they don't know how to operate in challenging environments. I love recessions, man. Never waste a good recession. Don't feel sorry for the weak. Dominate them. Somebody's gonna. They're not having bad luck. They're not victims. They're average thinkers, and they take average actions. And if they haven't read this book, they know what they're going to end up with without even reading this book. Average. The marketplace is brutal. It's not political. It's not Democrat. It's not Republican. It's not independent, baby. It's brutal. And it will punish anyone and everyone who does not take the right amount of action. Now is your time to shift into making your every thought and action aimed at dominating your sector, your market, your competition, and every thought of your potential clients. Quit thinking about the competition and quit thinking about competing. Despite what everyone says, competition is not healthy. Competition is for sissies. Exercise. What is the difference between dominating and competing? If competition is healthy, domination is. What is the difference between best practices and only practices? And write down a few examples. What are some practices you could do that would separate you right now from whoever you compete with? Chapter 11, breaking out of the middle class. Please don't take offense at what I write in this chapter. I know many of you spent your whole life trying to get to the middle class, and I'm about to tell you, it's the wrong goal. Now, have an open mind here, okay? I'm going to write an entire book on this topic one day, but for now, let's just think about breaking out of what I call the middle class mentality. I believe I can make the case that the middle class is the group hurt most by its members' thinking and actions, leaving themselves to be the most susceptible to insecurity and pain. Although this group that many people aspire to be a part of is also the group that seems to be the most trapped, most manipulated, and at most risk. Is the middle class really as good a status as you've been made to believe? Do you even know what it means to be middle class or what puts a person in this group? Before you make a decision about where you're going or the group you're striving to belong to, it would be wise to inspect the statistics of that group. So let's look at the incomes of the middle class. Reports from Wikipedia and the 2008 census suggest that the middle class income range is somewhere between $35,000 to $50,000 a year. Read another set of studies, and these figures are between $22,000 and $65,000 a year. It's no secret that it would be extremely difficult to live on either of these incomes in an urban area like New York or LA, much less ever feel financially secure. This experience is not what most people would consider a desirable situation. The middle class is further divided into the upper and lower middle class. Most people think middle class, they think one thing, but that's not how it is. The upper middle class usually consists of people who have substantial assets and household earnings, whether you know it or not, over $1 million a year. Although there is nothing to substantiate what makes the $1 million the mark, I guess it just sounds good. Most people consider $1 million to be a lot of money until they have $1 million. Then they realize it doesn't go very far since the person's decisions once they have $1 million and their considerations tend to change, their investments change, where they live changes as they enter this new income or this net worth bracket. Now, the people in the supposed upper middle class occupy noticeably higher positions By average, in their offices, they're considered more stable financially than their peers. This may very well be the case until some sort of economic destruction occurs like we've experienced recently. Then we tend to see that even this group, the upper middle class, is not very well protected. Admittedly, members of this group should experience a considerable rise in their incomes due to the economic growth of a nation in good times. They have higher disposable incomes than many of their counterparts in the lower middle class, which consists of people who have basic educational qualifications, typically, and annual incomes between $30,000 and $60,000. Now look, the lower middle class constitutes a large part of our country's total population. It's the majority. This set frequently struggles to reach the upper middle class. However, when economic hardships take hold, everyone gets pulled down. A client of mine recently asked me via text message, I think the 26th of a recent month, "Grant, I got to make $10,000 right now before the month's over to keep my doors open. How can I do this?" I happened to get this message during a Sunday football game. So I asked him, "Dude, are you watching the game right now?" He texts me back, Yeah, sure am." "What are you doing watching the game when you need $10,000? What are you doing taking a Sunday off to watch a football game? You should be out distributing flyers, spending every second of every hour trying to create income in excess of what you need. And by the way, you need $100,000, pal. You don't need 10. You need 100,000. You don't need 10,000, because if you need 10,000 to keep the doors open and you go get it, you're broke again." "Grant, Sunday's a day for rest." "Oh boy," I shot back. "Dude, are you kidding? It is for those that work the other 6 days and you hadn't been working. The Lord wasn't talking to the people who were short on funds, bro. Look, the Lord worked the other 6 days. That's why he said take the seventh day off. You ain't been working. So turn off the game, get off your couch, and go get the money you need. Quit being a middle-class slave and go create the income you need to secure your wealth and your financial freedom for yourself, your household, and your company." I hope he got the message. I think he did. Look, my client is at risk because he's been operating based on what he needs and therefore is just getting by. Unfortunately, this middle class mentality will not create financial security. It's average thinking. The banks dried up on this guy. He couldn't depend on credit anymore for his cushion, and he can now only depend on his actions. This is the problem with many members of the middle class. They go after what they deem necessary rather than ever going at something big. Anything that starts with middle can't be good. Most people believe that a comfortable middle-class life includes home, clothes, a few cars, vacation time, maybe an upper management job, and some money in the bank. However, depending on the period in history to which you are referring to, the term the middle class has had a variety of meanings, many of which have been and still are quite contradictory. It has referred to the class of people between peasants and nobility, whereas other definitions suggested the middle class had enough capital to rival nobles. What's my point? Look, there's a lot of misunderstandings on what it even means to be middle class. We've clearly come a long way from middle class being peasants or nobles, or middle class being a rival to the nobles. But which one is it now? For example, in India, the middle class is considered to be those who reside in an owner-occupied property, whereas a blue-collar job makes you middle class in the United States. And in Europe, that makes you a member of the working class. An important distinction that I'd like to make is my own reference to the middle class as a mindset rather than an income level. Someone who makes $1 million a year may still adopt middle-class thinking and actions. It is more of a mentality that creates the trap that will cause you to fail. The middle class is in a large part a goal that will not provide you with what you truly want. It is middle, normal, or average, synonymous with terms we've already deemed as highly unattractive and unworkable. Come on, man. Middle don't mean extraordinary, right? But what does middle mean to most people nowadays? In February 2009, authoritative weekly publication, The Economist, announced that over half the world's population now belongs to this group, the middle class, as a result of rapid growth in emerging countries. The article characterized middle class as having a reasonable amount of discretionary income and not having to live from hand to mouth as the poor do. It was defined as beginning at the point where people have roughly a third of their income left for discretionary spending after paying for basic food and shelter. Dude, that makes most of us poor, not middle class. However, almost no member of today's middle class has near one-third of his or her income left for discretionary income to spend. This group is currently being hammered by something called the middle class squeeze, a situation in which increases in wages fail to keep up with the cost of living for these same middle class earners. At the same time, the phenomenon of the middle class squeeze, where wages don't keep up, it fails to have the same impact on top wage earners. Add to that the fact that much of the supposed middle class's wealth has come from assuming debt and home equity calculations that were mere ink. Dude, it wasn't wealth. Persons belonging to the middle class frequently find that their dependence upon credit, worsened by the collapse of the housing market, prevents them from maintaining a middle class lifestyle, making downward mobility a threat to counteract aspirations of upward mobility. You want to go up, right? You want to do better? Look, that's the gravity and resistance I talked about earlier. It's the unexpected conditions that I mentioned. This group then experiences middle class income declines as jobs are lost. Jobs are lost, they quit paying people more money. For the first time in our history, we're seeing more men lose jobs than women because higher paid males are being let go in favor of keeping their counterparts. At the same time, the prices of necessary items, energy, education, housing, insurance, food, continue to increase while wages are flat or decrease. This kind of squeeze always affects the largest groups of people in any given population. The wealthy don't depend on income and debt, and the poor receive help for which the middle class aren't qualified. For most people, being middle class means having a reliable job with fair to good pay, consistent health care, a fairly comfortable home in a nice neighborhood, a good education, whatever that means, time off for vacations, this is highly valued, and money in a 401k that you have no control of and that hopefully is growing by some fat cat on Wall Street that might allow for your decent retirement one day. Hope you don't live too long. Yet all this, taken for granted for so long, is now in complete turmoil. Middle class is being squeezed. I mean, I don't even know if you call it a squeeze. It's more like the middle class hammer. And hopes at best that you might hold on to recover your past achievements. Maybe your inequity position on your home. Maybe one day makes it up and you're not underwater. Look, this group's average income is steadily decreasing. Its net worth is decreasing. If that's desirable, I'm confused. Its members' jobs are in jeopardy, and their savings and investments have been put at risk. The greatly appreciated vacation of the past will probably be more like a visit to the neighborhood park. What is the point of me telling you all this? Ask people in the middle class if this feels secure or desirable. And although they may claim that they're grateful not to be poor and feeding hand to mouth, they will likely tell you they feel more like a member of the working class than the middle class. Ask a guy making $250 a year if he feels rich. Consider as well the fact that the dollar is worth less today, 40% less than it was worth just not long ago, and will be worth even less tomorrow. Someone who's making $60,000 a year pays $15,000 in taxes. If that person's lucky, he or she has $45,000 left over, which is really only worth what? Maybe $30,000 or less to handle homes, schools, insurance, food, car payments, fuel, medical emergencies, vacation savings. Sound desirable to you? Middle class was a dream sold to countless Americans as a good goal to go for. Yet in reality, it is really only close to good and probably better described as a mousetrap with a big fat piece of cheese on it. I contend that the middle class is the most suppressed, restricted, and confined socioeconomic demographic on this planet. Those who desire to be a part of it are compelled, hypnotized, convinced, and persuaded to think and act in a certain way where just enough is the reward. The idea that one would only have enough to be comfortable or adequately satisfied is a concept that has been sold by the educational systems, the media, politicians to convince entire populations of people to settle instead of strive for abundance and success. However, it only takes a bit of waking up to discover the middle class is a promise without fulfillment. Today, the wealthiest 5% of people control $80 trillion. You understand that? The wealthiest 5% of people on this planet control $80 trillion, which is more money than has been created in the history of mankind. If you knew that you had the same energy, same creativity, same intelligence, same go-farness to make it to the top 5%, would you give it a try or would you go for the middle class? Exercise. Hey, before you read this chapter, what was your understanding of the middle class? 2, what are the income levels of the middle class? 3, what does middle class now mean to you? Chapter 12, obsession isn't a disease, it's a gift. The dictionary defines the term obsessed as the domination of one's thoughts or feelings by a persistent idea, image, or desire. That doesn't sound bad to me. Although the rest of the world tends to treat this mindset, obsession, like a disease, I believe it is the perfect adjective for how you must approach success. To dominate your sector, your goal, dream, or ambition, you must first dominate your every interest, thought, and consideration. Obsession is not a bad thing here. It is a requirement to get where you want to go. In fact, you want to be so fanatical about success and the creation of success that the world knows you will not compromise and will not go away. And until you become completely obsessed with your mission, no one will take you seriously. Until the world understands that you're not going away, that you are 100% committed and have complete and utter conviction and will persist in pursuing your project, you will not get the attention you need and the support you desire. In this context, obsession is like a fire. You want to build it so big that people feel compelled to sit around in admiration. And as with a fire, you have to keep adding wood to sustain the heat and the glow. You obsess over how to keep your fire burning or it will turn to ashes. To create a 10X reality, you have to follow up every action with an obsession to see it through to success. You need to stay seriously motivated to take 10X actions every day. Though people take action constantly, we know that much of this isn't the kind of action that's actually going to get them anywhere. Most people are doing nothing or have already given up, and others retreat in an attempt to avoid failure and negative experiences. Huge segments of the population are merely operating at normal levels, average levels, in order to get by and fit in. Each of these groups lacks the obsession to see their actions all the way through to success. Most people only exert enough effort for it to feel like work, whereas the most successful follow up every action with an obsession to see it through to a reward. If you become obsessed with your idea, your purpose, your goal, you will become equally addicted to the idea of making it actually work. Anyone who makes it his or her mission to create long-term positive 10X survival will have to approach each moment, decision, action, each day with this level of fixation. After all, if your ideas do not excessively preoccupy your own thoughts, then how can you expect them to ever preoccupy the thoughts of others? Something has to absorb your thinking every second of every day, so what will it be? Be obsessed with something. Make your dreams, your goals, and your missions, your mind's actions, dominant concern. The word obsessed tends to have negative connotations because many people believe that obsession with something or someone is usually destructive or harmful. But show me one person who has achieved greatness, extraordinary success, without being obsessed at some level. I dare you. You simply cannot do it. Any individual or group that has accomplished something significant was completely obsessed with the idea of making it happen. Whether it was an artist, musician, inventor, businessman, businesswoman, change agent, philanthropist, a forward thinker. Look, their greatness, the products they created, was a result of fixation, obsession, even an addiction to making something big happen. Someone once asked me, "Have you always been obsessed with success and work?" I answered, "Absolutely not." At first, in the very beginning, I was completely obsessed until about the age of 10. Then I let go of it and didn't become so obsessed until again when I was 25. I've remained that way to some greater or lesser degree ever since the age of 25. And I must tell you, I regret those years I was not obsessed with my dreams and my goals. I can tell you that my life has gone much better since I've been passionate and always went better when I was completely obsessed by my dreams and my goals. Even when things went wrong, I was better off being obsessed. I recently saw a television interview with the Israeli president, Shimon Peres. Mr. Peres was 87 years old at the time and had done 900 interviews in the previous 18 months. His obsession with his mission makes him seem youthful and energetic despite his age. Even those who may not believe in his mission have to admire his commitment to his mission, which is evidenced by his claim that work is better than vacation, and it is important to have a purpose to wake up to each day. Countless truly successful people agree with the sentiment that their careers do not feel like work, but rather something they love to do. That is obsession at its best. Children are a wonderful example of inherent obsession. They are almost instantly fixated with any task they encounter, learning, mimicking, discovering, playing, and utilizing their full energy for whatever captures their interest in the moment. Unless some part of their development has been delayed or hampered, no child approaches his or her activities without thorough obsession and complete preoccupation, fixation with whatever it is they desire in that moment. Be it a fat pacifier, a toy, food, daddy's attention, or an urgent need to be changed. In this way, we see how obsession is a natural human state. That's right, obsession is a natural human state. It doesn't become a problem until a parent, caretaker, or teacher, and eventually society as a whole, begins suppressing this fixation or obsession. They often make the child feel as if his or her commitment to a goal, any goal in fact, is wrong rather than something natural and very right. At this point, many children begin to assume that their interests, their intense interest in life, and their discovery for life, their innate commitment to being fully engaged, is somehow wrong or unnatural. They have essentially been bullied by others who have long ago given up on their own obsessions in order to change the behavior of those still obsessed. This is when a person moves from higher levels of commitment and action and drops down into lower average levels of actions. Lest you think I'm talking about something with which I have no personal experience, I should tell you that I've just had my first child, and I will admit that although her obsessive nature rears its head at inconvenient times for me, I never want to suppress or stop that. It is my fervent wish that my daughter becomes obsessed with whatever her dreams are, that she never gives up achieving those dreams and then spends the rest of her life improving on them. I love the feeling that comes with being obsessed about an idea. I admire seeing others who are that fanatical and committed. Who isn't moved by people or groups that go after things in which they believe with their complete heart? Or who is so consumed by their ideas that they wake up to their dreams each day, work on them all day long, and then go to sleep and actually dream about them throughout the night? As soon as other people are able to see your intention, your conviction, and commitment in the passion of the individual's thoughts, ideas, and movements, they will get out of the way. I suggest that you become obsessed with the things you want. Otherwise, you're going to spend a lifetime being obsessed with making up excuses as to why you didn't get the life you wanted. It is unfortunate that people with this kind of voracious obsession and fierce drive, this fixation for success, are somehow categorized as off-balance, work-addicted, obsessive, in a bad way, and a whole litany of other labels. Just imagine, what if the world saw a person's unwavering passion, undying obsession, and a bonfire-like desire to see their goals all the way through as gifts rather than as defects or diseases? Wouldn't we all accomplish more? Why do people have to turn a passion for excellence and an obsession to succeed into something negative? It's interesting, however, that once the obsessed finally do become successful, they're no longer labeled as crazy, but instead become geniuses, exceptions to the rule, and extraordinary. What if the world admired, expected, and even demanded that we each operate every single day with an obsessive focus on our goals and dreams? What if we actually punished the people who didn't act with obsessive passion, commitment, and we then rewarded those who saw their projects all the way through to success? Our society would be overwhelmed with inventions, solutions, new products, and higher levels of efficiency. What if the world encouraged obsession instead of judging it and mislabeling it? What if the only thing standing in the way of your greatness was that you just had to go after it obsessively, persistently, and as though your life depended on it? Well, it does. Would human beings have made it into space if a team of people hadn't been obsessed with making it into space? Can a country become great without its leaders being obsessed with greatness? Would any remarkable leader water down his or her dreams and encourage the team to adopt a take-it-or-leave-it attitude? Look, of course not. Do you want your team drugged, lethargic, and robotic, or obsessed with positive outcome and victory? Never cut anything. Never dilute greatness. Never pull back on your horsepower, and never put a limit on your ambition, your drive, and your passion. Demand obsession of yourself and all those around you. Never make it wrong to be obsessed. Instead, make it your goal. Obsession is what you will need to set 10x goals and then to follow them up with 10x actions. Remember, as well, that making your goal too small won't allow you to gather the right fuel or take the right amount of action to break through the resistance, competition, and changing conditions. Nothing great will ever happen without someone becoming obsessed with the concept and then staying obsessed while approaching each task, each challenge, and each moment as vital, necessary, and a must. The ability to be obsessed is not a disease. It's a gift. Exercise. I want you to write down the names of three people that you know have been obsessed and then later did something great. Number two, what good thing do you need to be obsessed about again in your life? Number three, why is it better to be obsessed than not be obsessed? And number four, what goal would cause you to become obsessed? Chapter 13, Go All In and Overcommit. Now that I hopefully have rehabilitated your opinion about the nature of obsession, let's discuss what we have to do to get you all in on every action and fully commit to every opportunity. You know, most people are familiar with this all-in concept as a poker term. It's what takes place when a player puts all of his chips at risk and either gets knocked out or doubles up. Though I'm not talking about money or chips here, I'm referring to a much more important bet: your efforts, creativity, energy, your ideas, and persistence. Massive action is not like a poker table. You never run out of action chips in life. You never can use up all your energy and effort by committing yourself fully. The most valuable chips you have are not money. It's your mindset, your actions, it's persistence and creativity. See, you can go all in with energy as many times as you want, because even if you fail, you can keep going all in. Most of society discourages the all-in mentality because we are taught to play it safe and not put everything at risk. We're encouraged to conserve and protect ourselves from losses rather than to go for the big payoff. Look, the giants on this planet are willing to make the big plays. They're willing to go all in. This mindset is yet again based on the myth that your energy, your creativity, and your efforts are material things with limited quantities that can't be replaced. But it's not true. There are certain things in life that do have limits, but you don't unless you impose limits on yourself. It's vital that you get your head completely reworked about taking action and that you understand there is no limit to how many times you can continue to take new action. Look, you can fail or succeed as many times as you want and then do it over and over again. Also, you can't ever hit it out of the park if you don't initially make contact and swing for the fences. And you will never hit it big if you don't discipline yourself to be all in when you don't take action. We have all heard the fable of the tortoise and the hare. The implied lesson, of course, is that the tortoise wins because he plods along and takes his time, whereas the hare rushes, becomes tired, and misses his opportunity to win. We're supposed to derive from this beautiful little fable that we should become tortoises, individuals who approach our goals steadily and slowly. If there was a third player, however, in the fable, who had the speed of the hare and the steadfastness of the tortoise, he would smoke them both and have no competition. See, the fable would then be called smoked. The suggestion here is to approach your goals like the tortoise and the hare by attacking them ruthlessly from the beginning and also staying with them throughout the course of the race until finality. Remember, there are no shortages of how many times you can get up and continue. There's no failure unless you quit. It is impossible for you to use up or exhaust all your energy. It is impossible for you to exhaust your creativity. It is impossible for you to run out of ideas. Look, you can never lose the ability to come up with new dreams. There is no shortage on this. You'll always be able to create more energy, to think creatively, to look at a situation or event differently, to give someone another call, to use another tactic, or act with more persistence. There will always be another hand for you to play. There will always be another day and another chance. If the bank you are working with continues to refill you with new supplies of energy, creativity, and persistence, then why not go all in on every hand? Entrepreneurs, and especially salespeople, suffer most when they fail to go all in, a topic discussed in my first book, Sell to Survive. Many sales professionals give themselves much more credit for trying to close the deal than they actually deserve, and they think they're doing so much more often than they actually are. In reality, most salespeople never even ask for the order the first time, much less 5, 6, or 7 times. My company was recently hired to conduct a mystery shop campaign that validated this. We did this work for an international company to identify where the breakdowns in their sales process were occurring. We were trying to collect information on where the franchises needed the most help. We visited more than 500 locations to see what percentage of the time the sales force was able to position the client to even ask for the order the first time. To the company's amazement, 63% of the locations shopped never even presented the client with a proposal to purchase, much less asked them to buy. This company was about to spend millions of dollars on customer satisfaction and product training programs when in reality, this is not their problem. The franchises and their sales team feared failure and rejection and were not even playing in the hand, much less going all in. Look, if a client comes to you and you get a chance to get in front of a client and talk about your product, but never then present a proposal to that client, I assure you, you will not get the business 100% of the time. Society has successfully taught most of us to play it safe rather than to go all in with every customer in every opportunity every time. This is perpetuated in the business world with things like closing ratios, which supposedly reflect the success rate of a salesperson. I'll tell you what I do. I'm willing to go for it with every customer every time and have the lowest closing ratio of everyone, but I'll have the highest production. All in, man, all in. I don't care how many times I bust out. I'll just reload my chips and play again. See, I can't go broke. Think about it. What's the worst thing that can happen to you if you just totally go for it? You may lose the customer, but so what? You still have unlimited resources to give it your all with your next client. You have everything to gain and you have nothing to lose. You simply have to rethink your approach. This brings me to the topic of overcommitting, another frowned upon and misunderstood issue in business today. How many times have you been told to undercommit and overdeliver? I have never heard anything so backward and ridiculous in my life. Let's say you're putting on a Broadway show that you're advertising to the public. Should you announce that you have a mediocre cast with just average singing ability and then wait until opening night to overdeliver? Of course not. See, this phrase of undercommit and overdeliver suggests that overcommitting, or at the very least fully committing, somehow puts you in danger. If you're then not able to deliver as promised, supposedly, you'll leave the other party dissatisfied. Well, hey, why not overcommit in your promise and then exceed by over-delivering? Tell everyone about your spectacular Broadway cast and compel them to show up. Overcommit and over-deliver. I find that the greater the commitment I make to a client, the higher my level of delivery naturally becomes. It is as though I'm promising to both them and myself to reach a new level of what I can and am willing to do for them. The more energy I devote to the market, the more energy I devote to my clients or my family, the more intent I am upon delivering exactly what I said I was going to deliver. This, of course, goes back to acting with 10x effort rather than 1x effort. It's easy for someone to claim to be giving 110%, but then fail to fully commit in the first place, either because the person is playing it safe or they're afraid he or she won't perform to the level necessary. A common problem faced by most businesses is increasing appointments in order to present or show your product or idea to clients. The more appointments you could actually present to, the more appointments you could get, the more product you could show, the more successful you'd be. This is an experience that many businesses and individuals have. People who request an appointment, you're asking to get an appointment from someone, you're not willing to overcommit to the person who has to give up his or her valuable time in order to see you. Look, you need to make grand claims. You need to overcommit. You need to make extreme promises that will immediately separate you from the other masses of people that are trying to get appointments as well. And this will therefore force you to deliver at 10x levels. The only way to increase appointments and solve your business problem is to increase the number of people with whom you speak and then amplify the reason why this person should give you their time. The same goes for every step of the sales process. Whether it involves follow-ups, flyers, regular mails, emails, social media, phone calls, personal visits, events, meetings, or whatever action you're taking, dude, got to overcommit. Overcommit your energy, your resources, your creativity, and your persistence. Know that you're all in on every activity every time you take an action, every day you're in business. Now, you might worry, as so many people do, about being able to deliver. And that is certainly a problem. However, as we discussed earlier, you need new problems. They're signs that you're making progress and heading in the right direction. Remember, new problems means you're moving in the right direction. Learn to commit first and figure out how to show up later. That's right. Commit first all the way and then figure out how to show up later. You will. Most people simply never bother to perform and instead spend their time trying to wrap their heads around things that may never happen to them. Oh my gosh, what am I going to do when I get there? Don't worry about it. Commit first. Anyone who doesn't face new problems, but who instead grapples with the same old little problems his or her whole life isn't moving forward. Simply put, if you're not creating new problems for yourself, then you're not taking enough action. You need to face new issues and new dilemmas that will challenge you to find and create new solutions. Wouldn't it be nice if you had too many people to see at 2 p.m.? Or if you had a line outside your restaurant because there were so many people waiting for a table? Wouldn't those be good problems? You know, one of the major differences between successful and unsuccessful people is that the former look for problems to resolve, whereas the latter, the unsuccessful, actually make every attempt to avoid problems. So remember, overcommit, be all in, and take massive levels of action, follow up by massive amounts of more actions. You'll create new problems, and I promise you, you will deliver at levels that will not just amaze your clients, but will amaze you. Exercise. What does it mean to you to go all in? Why do most members of society discourage going all in? What is the reason why salespeople fail? Fill in the following. If you blank commit and blank deliver, you'll make yourself grow because blank. And lastly, why do you want new problems? Chapter 14, expand, never contract. As of the writing of this book, our country is still experiencing very serious economic stress. Unemployment numbers and financial uncertainty are reaching heights not seen since the Great Depression. During major economic contractions like these, the world becomes convinced to reduce, save, to be careful, and stay cautious. Although this mindset focuses on self-preservation and protection of assets, it is the very kind of thinking that will guarantee you never get what you want. And although the majority of the world has entered a state of contraction, small percentages of people and companies are still capitalizing by expanding. These people and companies understand that these times of tightening by the masses are unique opportunities to take from those who are taking a defensive posture because they're reducing their spending. Because contracting is a form of retreating, it violates the concept of the 10X rule, which demands that you continue to act, produce, and create in massive quantities regardless of the situations or the economic circumstances. Now, I will admit that it can be very, very difficult and counterintuitive to expand while others are promoting that you should protect yourself. However, it's an approach you must adopt in order to take advantage of opportunity. Remember, regardless of what is happening in the world at any given moment, most people are not taking massive action. Although there are, of course, times when you must defend, retreat, and conserve, you should only do this for very short periods of time and only in order that you prepare yourself to reinforce and attack again. You must never contract as a continued business effort. Although we frequently seem to hear reports of companies that fail because they expanded too fast, the case for many of them probably wasn't so simple. Most companies fail not because they stay on the offensive, but because they don't properly prepare themselves for expansion and cannot dominate their sector. The idea of constant, unwavering expansion is counterintuitive. It's even unpopular. However, it will separate you from the rest of the pack more than any other single activity. The task of expanding when others are contracting should not be reduced to some simplistic concept. This is a very difficult discipline to apply in the real world. Yet once you get into the groove of making it your innate, natural method of responding, the ability to continuously, relentlessly attack any activity will give way to forward movement. Any disagreement with this comes because most people only attack to the point where they meet resistance, and then they back off. It's kind of like challenging the schoolyard bully and then running away. It always turns out badly. If you approach trials in this way, challenges, the market, your client, and your competition, they're not going to believe that you're committed to a persistent attack. Therefore, they will threaten or criticize you, and then you're going to back off. Look, you'll figure in your own mind that it didn't work. But the only reason why it didn't work is because you didn't stick with your attack. You didn't stick with it long enough for the market, your clients, and your competition to submit to your effort. Repeated attacks over extended periods of time will always prove successful. You must implement the tactic of expansion, persistent expansion, regardless of whether the economy and your surroundings are encouraging. I say this because we live in a society that promotes contraction most of the time. And when it does support expansion, it's typically too late in the cycle. Hence, the recent real estate meltdown. News of contraction should serve as an indicator for you to do the contrary. You never want to blindly follow the masses. They're almost always wrong. Instead of following the pack, lead the pack. The way out is to expand, to push, to take action, to lead, regardless of what others are saying and doing. I watched others in the same sector I work in start to cut their staff and their promotion dollars during the Great Recession, which served as a green light for me to augment my own forces. I didn't cut employees. I didn't cut promotional spending. Instead, I increased both. Even though I saw our revenue shrink like the rest of the world's, I opted to cut my own salary because the money wasn't there as an alternative, and then redirected those monies to promote my business, to keep staff on, to build new products. This helped me to increase my footprint and take market share from the organizations that were retreating. In fact, I spent more money on advertising, marketing, and promotion in the course of the 18 months than I had in the previous 18 years. I realized how counterintuitive this was and is for most people, and I fully admit it was terrifying. It was scary. Every night I went to bed wondering if I was doing the right thing, second-guessing my every action. Yet I knew that if I could continue, if I could persist to keep pushing forward while they retreated, tremendous ground would be gained. Even more important than the money I spent were the demands I put on my staff at the same time, and especially the demands I started to put on myself to repeatedly expand the use of our most valuable resources, not money, but energy, creativity, persistence, and contacting our clients. By doing so, we immediately increased production, outflow in every area. Phone calls out, emails out, e-newsletters, social media posts, personal visits, speaking engagements, teleconference, webinars, Skypes, everything. We just poured it on. Over that 18-month period, over a year and a half, I then published 4 books, introduced 4 new sales programs, produced more than 700 segments of training material for a virtual training site that we created. I delivered 600 radio interviews. I wrote more than 150, probably closer to 200 articles or blog entries, and made thousands of personal phone calls. While the rest of the world withdrew, we expanded on every front possible. Pretty much everyone in the world was being convinced that the only saving grace at that time was to save, and so they did. It's always intriguing to me that when people start saving money, they immediately begin saving everything else, almost automatically. This is very important to understand. It's as though the mind is unable to distinguish between saving paper bills or numbers in a bank, what you call money, and not also save creativity, save their energy, save their persistence, and save all their effort. They seem to do all at the same time. The whole world in this 18-month period of time still going on today, the whole world started to hold back on expenditure of not just dollars, but their effort. While just a few people like myself, the obsessed, expanded. Who do you think comes out on top in those moments? People have asked me in my seminars how and why I decided to expand at a time where things were so uncertain. And my answer to them was always, look, I'd rather die in expansion than die in contraction. I'd rather fail pushing forward than fail in a retreat. Consider this yourself. At which of the four degrees of action introduced in Chapter 7 do you choose to operate? If you're going to die, which